and again, with a greater downward pressure, and she would be entirely shut in and alone. Even groaning increased the agony. And so she lay there as the late afternoon slipped by. The front door had opened and closed. Bryony would have gone out with her mood, probably to be by water, by the pool or the lake, or perhaps she had gone as far as the river. Emily heard a careful tread on the stairs. Cecilia at last taking the flowers up to the guests' room, a simple errand she had been asked many times that day to perform. Then later, Betty calling to Danny, and the sound of the trap on the gravel, and Cecilia going down to meet the visitors, and soon, spreading through the gloom, the faintest tang of a cigarette. She had been asked 1,000 times not to smoke on the stairs, but she would be wanting to impress Leon's friend, and that in itself might not be a bad thing. Voices echoing in the hall. Danny struggling up with the luggage and coming down again, and silence. Cecilia would have taken Leon and Mr. Marshall to the pool to drink the punch that Emily herself had made that morning. She heard the scampering of a four-legged creature coming down the stairs. The twins, wanting the pool and about to be disappointed that it had been taken over. She tumbled away into a doze and was woken by the drone of a man's voice in the nursery and children answering. Surely not Leon, who would be inseparable from his sister now they were reunited. It would be Mr. Marshall, whose room was just along from the nursery, and he was talking to the twins, she decided, rather than Lola. Emily wondered if they were being impertinent, for each twin seemed to behave as though his social obligations were halved. Now Betty was coming up the stairs, calling to them as she came, a little too harshly, perhaps, given Jackson's ordeal of the morning. Bath time, tea time, bedtime, the hinge of the day. These childhood sacraments of water, food, and sleep had all but vanished from the daily round. Bryony's late and unexpected appearance had kept them alive in the household well into Emily's 40s, and how soothing, how fixing they had been. The lanolin soap and thick white bath sheet, the girlish prattle echoing in the steamy bathroom acoustic, enfolding her in the towel, trapping her arms and taking her onto her lap for a moment of babyish helplessness that Bryony had revelled in not so long ago. But now baby and bathwater had vanished behind a locked door, though that was rare enough, for the girl always looked in need of a wash and a change of clothes. She had vanished into an intact inner world of which the writing was no more than the visible surface, the protective crust which even, or especially, a loving mother could not penetrate. Her daughter was always off and away in her mind, grappling with some unspoken, self-imposed problem, as though the weary, self-evident world could be reinvented by a child. Useless to ask Bryony what she was thinking. There was a time one would have received a bright and intricate response that would in turn have unfolded silly and weighty questions to which Emily gave her best answers. And while the meandering hypotheses they indulged were hard to recall in detail now, she knew she never spoke so well as she had to her 11-year-old lastborn. No dinner table, no shaded margin of a tennis court ever heard her so easily and richly associative. Now the demons of self-consciousness and talent had struck her daughter dumb, and though Bryony was no less loving, at breakfast she had sidled up and locked fingers with her, Emily mourned the passing of an age of eloquence. She would never again speak like that to anyone, and this was what it meant to want another child. Soon she would be 47. The muted thunder of the plumbing. She had not noticed it begin, ceased with a judder that shook the air. Now Hermione's boys would be in the bathroom, their narrow, bony little bodies at each end of the tub, and the same folded white towels would be on the faded blue wicker chair, and underfoot the giant cork mat with a corner chewed away by a dog long dead. But instead of prattle, dread silence, and no mother, only Betty, whose kindly heart no child would ever discover. How could Hermione have a nervous breakdown, the generally preferred term for her friend who worked in the wireless? How could she choose silence and fear and sorrow in her children? Emily supposed that she herself should be overseeing this bath time. But she knew that even if the knives were not poised above her optic nerve, she would attend to her nephews only out of duty. They were not her own. It was as simple as that. And they were little boys, therefore fundamentally uncommunicative, with no gift for intimacy. And worse, they had diluted their identities, for she had never found this missing triangle of flesh. One could only know them generally. She eased herself onto an elbow and brought the glass of water to her lips. It was beginning to fade, the presence of her animal tormentor, and now she was able to arrange two pillows against the headboard in order to sit up. This was a slow and awkward manoeuvre because she was fearful of sudden movement, and thus the creaking of the bed springs was prolonged and half obscured the sound of a man's voice. Propped on her side, she froze, with the corner of a pillow clenched in one hand, and beamed her raw attention into every recess of the house. There was nothing, and then, like a lamp turned on and off in total darkness, there was a little squeal of laughter abruptly smothered. Lola, then, in the nursery with Marshall. She continued to settle herself and lay back at last and sipped her lukewarm water. This wealthy young entrepreneur might not be such a bad sort if he was prepared to pass the time of day entertaining children. Soon she would be able to risk turning on the bedside lamp, and within 20 minutes she might be able to rejoin the household and pursue the various lines of her anxiety. Most urgent was a sortie into the kitchen to discover whether it was not too late to convert the roast into cold cuts and salads. And then she must greet her son and appraise his friend and make him welcome. As soon as this was accomplished, she would satisfy herself that the twins were properly taken care of and perhaps allow them some sort of compensating treat. Then it would be time to make the telephone call to Jack, who would have forgotten to tell her he was not coming home. She would talk herself past the terse woman on the switchboard and the pompous young fellow in the outer office, and she would reassure her husband that there was no need to feel guilt. She would track down Cecilia and make sure that she had arranged the flowers as instructed, and that she should jolly well make an effort for the evening by taking on some of the responsibilities of a hostess, and that she wore something pretty and didn't smoke in every room. And then, most important of all, she should set off in search of Bryony, because the collapse of the play was a terrible blow, and the child would need all the comfort a mother could give. Finding her would mean exposure to unadulterated sunlight, and even the diminishing rays of early evening could provoke an attack. The sunglasses would have to be found then, and this, rather than the kitchen, would have to be the priority, because they were somewhere in this room, in a drawer, between a book, in a pocket, and it would be a bother to come upstairs again for them. She should also put on some flat-soled shoes in case Bryony had gone all the way to the river. And so Emily lay back against the pillows for another several minutes, her creature having slunk away, and patiently planned and revised her plans and refined an order for them. She would soothe the household, which seemed to her, from the sickly dimness of the bedroom, like a troubled and sparsely populated continent, from whose forested vastness competing elements made claims and counterclaims upon her restless attention. She had no illusions. Old plans, if one could ever remember them, the plans that time had overtaken, tended to have a febrile and over-optimistic grip on events. She could send her tendrils into every room of the house, but she could not send them into the future. She also knew that ultimately it was her own peace of mind she strove for. Self-interest and kindness were best not separated. Gently, she pushed herself upright and swung her feet to the floor and wriggled them into her slippers. Rather than risk drawing the curtains just yet, she turned on the reading light and tentatively began the hunt for her dark glasses. She had already decided where to look first. Chapter 7. The Island Temple, built in the style of Nicholas Rivette in the late 1780s, was intended as a point of interest, an eye-catching feature to enhance the pastoral ideal, and had, of course, no religious purpose at all. It was near enough to the water's edge, raised upon a projecting bank, to cast an interesting reflection in the lake, and from most perspectives, the row of pillars and the pediment above them were charmingly half-obscured by the elms and oaks that had grown up around. Closer to, the temple had a sorrier look. Moisture rising through a damaged, damp course had caused chunks of stucco to fall away. Sometime in the late 19th century, clumsy repairs were made with unpainted cement, which had turned brown and gave the building a mottled, diseased appearance. Elsewhere, the exposed laths, themselves rotting away, showed through like the ribs of a starving animal. The double doors that opened onto a circular chamber with a domed roof had long ago been removed, and the stone floor was thickly covered in leaves and leaf mould and the droppings of various birds and animals that wandered in and out. All the panes were gone from the pretty Georgian windows, smashed by Leon and his friends in the late 20s. The tall niches that at once contained statuary were empty but for the filthy ruins of spiderwebs. The only furniture was a bench carried in from the village cricket pitch. Again, the youthful Leon and his terrible friends from school. The legs had been kicked away and used to break the windows, and were lying outside, softly crumbling into the earth among the nettles and the incorruptible shards of glass. Just as the swimming pool pavilion behind the stable block imitated features of the temple, so the temple was supposed to embody references to the original Adam house, though nobody in the Tallis family knew what they were. Perhaps it was the style of column or the pediment or the proportions of the windows. At different times, but most often at Christmas, when moods were expansive, family members strolling over the bridges promised to research the matter, but no one cared to set aside the time when the busy new year began. More than the dilapidation, it was this connection, this lost memory of the temple's grander relation, which gave the useless little building its sorry air. The temple was the orphan of a grand society lady, and now, with no one to care for it, no one to look up to, the child had grown old before its time and let itself go. There was a tapering soot stain as high as a man on an outside wall where two tramps had once, outrageously, lit a bonfire to roast a carp that was not theirs. For a long time there had been a shrivelled boot lying exposed on grass, kept trim by rabbits. But when Bryony looked today, the boot had vanished, as everything would in the end. The idea that the temple, wearing its own black band, grieved for the burned-down mansion, that it yearned for a grand and invisible presence, bestowed a faintly religious ambience. Tragedy had rescued the temple from being entirely a fake. It is hard to slash at nettles for long without a story imposing itself, and Bryony was soon absorbed and grimly content, even though she appeared to the world like a girl in the grip of a terrible mood. She had found a slender hazel branch and stripped it clean. There was work to do, and she set about it. A tall nettle, with a preening look, its head coyly drooping and its middle leaves turned outward, like hands protesting innocence, this was Lola, and though she whimpered for mercy, the singing arc of a 3-foot switch cut her down at the knees and sent her worthless torso flying. This was too satisfying to let go, and the next several nettles were Lola too. This one, leaning across to whisper in the ear of its neighbour, was cut down with an outrageous lie on her lips. Here she was again, standing apart from the others, head cocked in poisonous scheming. Over there, she lauded it among a clump of young admirers and was spreading rumours about Bryony. It was regrettable, but the admirers had to die with her. Then she rose again, brazen with her various sins, pride, gluttony, avarice, uncooperativeness, and for each she paid with a life. Her final act of spite was to fall at Bryony's feet and sting her toes. When Lola had died enough, three pairs of young nettles were sacrificed for the incompetence of the twins. Retribution was indifferent and granted no special favours to children. Then playwriting itself became a nettle, became several, in fact. The shallowness, the wasted time, the messiness of other minds, the hopelessness of pretending, in the garden of the arts. It was a weed and had to die. No longer a playwright, and feeling all the more refreshed for that, and watching out for broken glass, she moved further round the temple, working along the fringe where the nibbled grass met the disorderly undergrowth that spilled out from among the trees. Flaying the nettles was becoming a self-purification, and it was childhood she set about now, having no further need for it. One spindly specimen stood in for everything she had been up until this moment, but that was not enough. Planting her feet firmly in the grass, she disposed of her old self year by year in 13 strokes. She severed the sickly dependency of infancy and early childhood, and the schoolgirl, eager to show off and be praised, and the 11-year-old's silly pride in her first stories and her reliance on her mother's good opinion. They flew over her left shoulder and lay at her feet. The slender tip of the switch made a two-tone sound as it sliced the air. "No more," she made it say. "Enough. Take that." Soon it was the action itself that absorbed her, and the newspaper report which she revised to the rhythm of her swipes. No one in the world could do this better than Bryony Tallis, who would be representing her country next year at the Berlin Olympics and was certain to win the gold. People studied her closely and marvelled at her technique, her preference for bare feet because it improved her balance. So important in this demanding sport, with every toe playing its part. The manner in which she led with the wrist and snapped the hand round only at the end of her stroke, the way she distributed her weight and used the rotation in her hips to gain extra power, her distinctive habit of extending the fingers of her free hand. No one came near her. Self-taught, the youngest daughter of a senior civil servant. Look at the concentration in her face, judging the angle, never fudging a shot, taking each nettle with inhuman precision. To reach this level required a lifetime's dedication, and how close she had come to wasting that life as a playwright. She was suddenly aware of the trap behind her, clattering over the first bridge. Leon, at last. She felt his eyes upon her. Was this the kid's sister he had last seen on Waterloo Station only 3 months ago, and now a member of an international elite? Perversely, she would not allow herself to turn and acknowledge him. He must learn that she was independent now of other people's opinion, even his. She was a grand master lost to the intricacies of her art. Besides, he was bound to stop the trap and come running down the bank, and she would have to suffer the interruption with good grace. The sound of wheels and hooves receding over the second bridge proved, she supposed, that her brother knew the meaning of distance and professional respect. All the same, a little sadness was settling on her as she kept hacking away, moving further round the island temple until she was out of sight of the road. A ragged line of chopped nettles on the grass marked her progress, as did the stinging white bumps on her feet and ankles. The tip of the hazel switch sang through its arc. Leaves and stems flew apart, but the cheers of the crowds were harder to summon. The colours were ebbing from her fantasy. Her self-loving pleasures in movement and balance were fading. Her arm was aching. She was becoming a solitary girl, swiping nettles with a stick. And at last she stopped and tossed it toward the trees and looked around her. The cost of oblivious daydreaming was always this moment of return, the realignment with what had been before and now seemed a little worse. Her reverie, once rich in plausible details, had become a passing silliness before the hard mass of the actual. It was difficult to come back. "Come back," her sister used to whisper when she woke her from a bad dream. Bryony had lost her godly power of creation, but it was only at this moment of return that the loss became evident. Part of a daydream's enticement was the illusion that she was helpless before its logic. Forced by international rivalry to compete at the highest level among the world's finest and to accept the challenges that came with preeminence in her field of nettle slashing, driven to push beyond her limits to assuage the roaring crowd and to be the best and, most importantly, unique. But of course, it had all been her, by her and about her. And now she was back in the world, not one she could make, but the one that had made her. And she felt herself shrinking under the early evening sky. She was weary of being outdoors, but she was not ready to go in. Was that really all there was in life, indoors or out? Wasn't there somewhere else for people to go? She turned her back on the island temple and wandered slowly over the perfect lawn the rabbits had made toward the bridge. In front of her, illuminated by the lowering sun, was a cloud of insects, each one bobbing randomly as though fixed on an invisible elastic string, a mysterious courtship dance or sheer insect exuberance that defied her to find a meaning. In a spirit of mutinous resistance, she climbed the steep grassy slope to the bridge, and when she stood on the driveway, she decided she would stay there and wait until something significant happened to her. This was the challenge she was putting to existence. She would not stir, not for dinner, not even for her mother calling her in. She would simply wait on the bridge, calm and obstinate, until events, real events, not her own fantasies, rose to her challenge and dispelled her insignificance. Chapter 8. In the early evening, high-altitude clouds in the western sky formed a thin yellow wash, which became richer over the hour, and then thickened until a filtered orange glow hung above the giant crests of parkland trees. The leaves became nutty brown, the branches glimpsed among the foliage oily black, and the desiccated grasses took on the colours of the sky. A fauvist dedicated to improbable colour might have imagined a landscape this way, especially once sky and ground took on a reddish bloom and the swollen trunks of elderly oaks became so black they began to look blue. Though the sun was weakening as it dropped, the temperature seemed to rise because the breeze that had brought faint relief all day had faded, and now the air was still and heavy. The scene, or a tiny portion of it, was visible to Robbie Turner through a sealed skylight window if he cared to stand up from his bath, bend his knees and twist his neck. All day long his small bedroom, his bathroom and the cubicle wedged between them, he called his study, had baked under the southern slope of the bungalow's roof. For over an hour, after returning from work, he lay in a tepid bath while his blood, and so it seemed, his thoughts warmed the water. Above him, the framed rectangle of sky slowly shifted through its limited segment of the spectrum, yellow to orange, as he sifted unfamiliar feelings and returned to certain memories again and again. Nothing palled. Now and then, an inch below the water's surface, the muscles of his stomach tightened involuntarily as he recalled another detail. a drop of water on her upper arm. Wet. An embroidered flower, a simple daisy, sewn between the cups of her bra. Her breasts wide apart and small. On her back, a mole half covered by a strap. When she climbed out of the pond, a glimpse of the triangular darkness her knickers were supposed to conceal. Wet. He saw it. He made himself see it again. The way her pelvic bones stretched the material clear of her skin. The deep curve of her waist. Her startling whiteness. When she reached for her skirt, a carelessly raised foot revealed a patch of soil on each pad of her sweetly diminishing toes. Another mole the size of a farthing on her thigh, and something purplish on her calf. A strawberry mark. A scar. Not blemishes. Adornments. He had known her since they were children, and he had never looked at her. At Cambridge, she came to his rooms once with a New Zealand girl in glasses and someone from her school when there was a friend of his from Downing there. They idled away an hour with nervous jokes and handed cigarettes about. Occasionally they passed in the street and smiled. She always seemed to find it awkward. "That's our cleaning lady's son," she might have been whispering to her friends as she walked on. He liked people to know he didn't care. "There goes my mother's employer's daughter," he once said to a friend. He had his politics to protect him, and his scientifically based theories of class, and his own rather forced self-certainty. "I am what I am." She was like a sister, almost invisible. That long, narrow face, the small mouth. If he had ever thought about her at all, he might have said she was a little horsey in appearance. Now he saw it was a strange beauty, something carved and still about the face, especially around the inclined planes of her cheekbones, with a wild flare to the nostrils and a full, glistening rosebud mouth. Her eyes were dark and contemplative. It was a statuesque look, but her movements were quick and impatient. That vase would still be in one piece if she had not jerked it so suddenly from his hands. She was restless, that was clear, bored and confined by the Tallis household, and soon she would be gone. He would have to speak to her soon. He stood up at last from his bath, shivering, in no doubt that a great change was coming over him. He walked naked through his study into the bedroom. The unmade bed, the mess of discarded clothes, a towel on the floor, the room's equatorial warmth, were disablingly sensual. He stretched out on the bed, face down into his pillow, and groaned. The sweetness of her, the delicacy, his childhood friend, and now in danger of becoming unreachable. To strip off like that. Yes. Her endearing attempt to seem eccentric, her stab at being bold, had an exaggerated homemade quality. Now she would be in agonies of regret and could not know what she had done to him. And all of this would be very well. It would be rescuable if she was not so angry with him over a broken vase that had come apart in his hands. But he loved her fury, too. He rolled onto his side, eyes fixed and unseeing, and indulged a cinema fantasy. She pounded against his lapels before yielding with a little sob to the safe enclosure of his arms and letting herself be kissed. She didn't forgive him. She simply gave up. He watched this several times before he returned to what was real. She was angry with him. And she would be angrier still when she knew he was to be one of the dinner guests. Out there in the fierce light, he hadn't thought quickly enough to refuse Leon's invitation. Automatically, he had bleated out his yes, and now he would face her irritation. He groaned again, and didn't care if he were heard downstairs, at the memory of how she had taken off her clothes in front of him, so indifferently, as though he were an infant. Of course. He saw it clearly now. The idea was to humiliate him. There it stood, the undeniable fact. Humiliation. She wanted it for him. She was not mere sweetness, and he could not afford to condescend to her, for she was a force. She could drive him out of his depth and push him under. But perhaps, he had rolled onto his back, he should not believe in her outrage. Wasn't it too theatrical? Surely she must have meant something better, even in her anger. Even in her anger, she had wanted to show him just how beautiful she was and bind him to her. How could he trust such a self-serving idea derived from hope and desire? He had to. He crossed his legs, clasped his hands behind his head, feeling his skin cool as it dried. What might Freud say? How about, she hid the unconscious desire to expose herself to him behind a show of temper? Pathetic hope. It was an emasculation, a sentence, and this, what he was feeling now, this torture, was his punishment for breaking her ridiculous vase. He should never see her again. He had to see her tonight. He had no choice anyway. He was going. She would despise him for coming. He should have refused Leon's invitation, but the moment it was made, his pulse had leaped and his bleated yes had left his mouth. He'd be in a room with her tonight, and the body he had seen, the moles, the pallor, the strawberry mark, would be concealed inside her clothes. He alone would know, and Emily, of course. But only he would be thinking of them. And Cecilia would not speak to him or look at him. Even that would be better than lying here groaning. No, it wouldn't. It would be worse. But he still wanted it. He had to have it. He wanted it to be worse. At last he rose, half-dressed, and went into his study and sat at his typewriter, wondering what kind of letter he should write to her. Like the bedroom and bathroom, the study was squashed under the apex of the bungalow's roof and was little more than a corridor between the two, barely 6 feet long and 5 feet wide. As in the other two rooms, there was a skylight framed in rough pine. Piled in a corner, his hiking gear, boots, alpenstock, leather knapsack. A knife-scarred kitchen table took up most of the space. He tilted back his chair and surveyed his desk as one might a life. At one end, heaped high against the sloping ceiling, were the folders and exercise books from the last months of his preparations for finals. He had no further use for his notes, but too much work, too much success was bound up with them, and he could not bring himself to throw them out yet. Lying partly across them were some of his hiking maps of North Wales, Hampshire and Surrey, and of the abandoned hike to Istanbul. There was a compass with slitted sighting mirror he had once used to walk without maps to Lulworth Cove. Beyond the compass were his copies of Auden's poems and Hausmann's A Shropshire Lad. At the other end of the table were various histories, theoretical treatises, and practical handbooks on landscape gardening. 10 typed-up poems lay beneath a printed rejection slip from Criterion magazine, initialled by Mr. Elliot himself. Closest to where Robbie sat were the books of his new interest. Gray's Anatomy was open by a folio pad of his own drawings. He had set himself the task of drawing and committing to memory the bones of the hand. He tried to distract himself by running through some of them now, murmuring their names. Capitate, haemate, triquetral, lunate. His best drawing so far, done in ink and coloured pencils, and showing a cross-section of the esophageal tract and the airways, was tacked to a rafter above the table. A pewter tankard with its handle missing held all the pencils and pens. The typewriter was a fairly recent Olympia, given to him on his 21st. By Jack Tallis at a lunchtime party held in the library. Leon had made a speech, as well as his father, and Cecilia had been there, surely. But Robbie could not remember a single thing they might have said to each other. Was that why she was angry now, because he had ignored her for years? Another pathetic hope. At the outer reaches of the desk, various photographs. The cast of Twelfth Night on the college lawn, himself as Malvolio, cross-gartered. How apt. There was another group shot of himself and the 30 French kids he had taught in a boarding school near Lille. In a Belle Époque metal frame tinged with verdigris was a photograph of his parents, Grace and Ernest, 3 days after their wedding. Behind them, just poking into the picture, was the front wing of a car, certainly not theirs, and further off, an Osthaus looming over a brick wall. It was a good honeymoon, Grace always said. 2 weeks picking hops with her husband's family and sleeping in a gypsy caravan parked in a farmyard. His father wore a collarless shirt. The neck scarf and the rope belt around his flannel trousers may have been playful Romany touches. His head and face were round, but the effect was not exactly jovial, for his smile for the camera was not wholehearted enough to part his lips, and rather than hold the hand of his young bride, he had folded his arms. She, by contrast, was leaning into his side, nestling her head on his shoulder and holding on to his shirt at the elbow awkwardly with both hands. Grace, always game and good-natured, was doing the smiling for two. But willing hands and a kind spirit would not be enough. It looked as though Ernest's mind was already elsewhere, already drifting 7 summers ahead to the evening when he would walk away from his job as the Tallis' gardener, away from the bungalow, without luggage, without even a farewell note on the kitchen table, leaving his wife and their 6-year-old son to wonder about him for the rest of their lives. Elsewhere, strewn between the revision notes, landscape gardening and anatomy piles, were various letters and cards. Unpaid battles. Letters from tutors and friends congratulating him on his first, which he still took pleasure in rereading, and others mildly querying his next step. The most recent, scribbled in brownish ink on Whitehall departmental notepaper, was a message from Jack Tallis agreeing to help with fees at medical school. There were application forms, 20 pages long, and thick, densely printed admission handbooks from Edinburgh and London, whose methodical, exacting prose seemed to be a foretaste of a new kind of academic rigour. But today they suggested to him not adventure and a fresh beginning, but exile. He saw it in prospect, the dull terrace street far from here, a floral wallpapered box with a lowering wardrobe and candlewick bedspread, the earnest new friends, mostly younger than himself, the formaldehyde vats, the echoing lecture room, every element devoid of her. From among the landscape books, he took the volume on Versailles he had borrowed from the Tallis Library. That was the day he first noticed his awkwardness in her presence. Kneeling to remove his work shoes by the front door, he had become aware of the state of his socks, holed at toe and heel, and for all he knew, odorous, and on impulse had removed them. What an idiot he had then felt, padding behind her across the hall and entering the library barefoot. His only thought was to leave as soon as he could. He had escaped through the kitchen and had to get Danny Hardman to go round the front of the house to collect his shoes and socks. She probably would not have read this treatise on the hydraulics of Versailles by an 18th-century Dane who extolled in Latin the genius of Le Nôtre. With the help of a dictionary, Robbie had read 5 pages in a morning and then given up and made do with the illustrations instead. It would not be her kind of book, or anyone's really, but she had handed it to him from the library steps, and somewhere on its leather surface were her fingerprints. Willing himself not to, he raised the book to his nostrils and inhaled. Dust, old paper, the scent of soap on his hands, but nothing of her. How had it crept up on him, this advanced stage of fetishizing the love object. Surely Freud had something to say about that in 3 essays on sexuality. And so did Keats, Shakespeare, and Petrarch, and all the rest. And it was in the Romance of the Rose. He had spent 3 years dryly studying the symptoms, which had seemed no more than literary conventions, and now, in solitude, like some ruffed and plumed courtier come to the edge of the forest to contemplate a discarded token, he was worshipping her traces, not a handkerchief, but fingerprints, while he languished in his lady's scorn. For all that, when he fed a sheet of paper into the typewriter, he did not forget the carbon. He typed the date and salutation and plunged straight into a conventional apology for his clumsy and inconsiderate behaviour. Then he paused. Was he going to make any show of feeling at all? And if so, at what level? If it's any excuse, I've noticed just lately that I'm rather light-headed in your presence. I mean, I've never gone barefoot into someone's house before. It must be the heat. How thin it looked, this self-protective levity. He was like a man with advanced TB pretending to have a cold. He flicked the return lever twice and rewrote, "It's hardly an excuse, I know, but lately I seem to be awfully light-headed around you. What was I doing walking barefoot into your house? And have I ever snapped off the rim of an antique vase before?" He rested his hands on the keys while he confronted the urge to type her name again. "See, I don't think I can blame the heat." Now jokiness had made way for melodrama or plaintiveness. The rhetorical questions had a clammy air. The exclamation mark was the first resort of those who shout to make themselves clearer. He forgave this punctuation only in his mother's letters, where a row of 5 indicated a jolly good joke. He turned the drum and typed an X. "Cecilia, I don't think I can blame the heat." Now the humour was removed, and an element of self-pity had crept in. The exclamation mark would have to be reinstated. Volume was obviously not its only business. He tinkered with his draft for a further quarter of an hour, then threaded in new sheets and typed up a fair copy. The crucial lines now read, "You be forgiven for thinking me mad, wandering into your house barefoot or snapping your antique vase. The truth is, I feel rather light-headed and foolish in your presence, see, and I don't think I can blame the heat. Will you forgive me? Robbie." Then after a few moments' reverie, tilted back on his chair, during which time he thought about the page at which his anatomy tended to fall open these days, he dropped forward and typed before he could stop himself, "In my dreams I kiss your cunt, your sweet, wet cunt. In my thoughts I make love to you all day long." There it was. Ruined. The draft was ruined. He pulled the sheet clear of the typewriter, set it aside, and wrote his letter out in longhand, confident that the personal touch fitted the occasion. As he looked at his watch, he remembered that before setting out he should polish his shoes. He stood up from his desk, careful not to thump his head on the rafter. He was without social unease, inappropriately so in the view of many. At a dinner in Cambridge once, during a sudden silence round the table, someone who disliked Robbie asked loudly about his parents. Robbie held the man's eye and answered pleasantly that his father had walked out long ago and that his mother was a charlady who supplemented her income as an occasional clairvoyant. His tone was of easygoing tolerance of his questioner's ignorance. Robbie elaborated upon his circumstances, then ended by asking politely about the parents of the other fellow. Some said that it was innocence or ignorance of the world that protected Robbie from being harmed by it, that he was a kind of holy fool who could step across the drawing-room equivalent of hot coals without harm. The truth, as Cecilia knew, was simpler. He had spent his childhood moving freely between the bungalow and the main house. Jack Tallis was his patron. Leon and Cecilia were his best friends, at least until grammar school. At university, where Robbie discovered that he was cleverer than many of the people he met, his liberation was complete. Even his arrogance need not be on display. Grace Turner was happy to take care of his laundry. How else beyond hot meals to show mother love when her only baby was 23? But Robbie preferred to shine his own shoes. In a white singlet and the trousers of his suit, he went down the short, straight run of stairs in his stockinged feet carrying a pair of black brogues. By the living room door was a narrow space that ended in the frosted glass door of the front entrance, through which a diffused blood-orange light embossed the beige and olive wallpaper in fiery honeycomb patterns. He paused, one hand on the doorknob, surprised by the transformation, then he entered. The air in the room felt moist and warm and faintly salty. A session must have just ended. His mother was on the sofa with her feet up and her carpet slippers dangling from her toes. "Molly was here," she said, and moved herself upright to be sociable. "And I'm glad to tell you she's going to be all right." Robbie fetched the shoeshine box from the kitchen, sat down in the armchair nearest his mother, and spread out a page of a 3-day-old daily sketch on the carpet. "Well done, you," he said. "I heard you at it and went up for a bath." He knew he should be leaving soon. He should be polishing his shoes. But instead he leaned back in the chair, stretched his great length and yawned. "Weeding. What am I doing with my life?" There was more humour than anguish in his tone. He folded his arms and stared at the ceiling while massaging the instep of one foot with the big toe of the other. His mother was staring at the space above his head. "Now, come on. Something's up. What's wrong with you? And don't say nothing." Grace Turner became the Tallis' cleaner the week after Ernest walked away. Jack Tallis did not have it in him to turn out a young woman and her child. In the village, he found a replacement gardener and handyman who was not in need of a tied cottage. At the time, it was assumed Grace would keep the bungalow for a year or two before moving on or remarrying. Her good nature and her knack with the polishing, her dedication to the surface of things, was the family joke, made her popular. But it was the adoration she aroused in the 6-year-old Cecilia and her 8-year-old brother Leon that was the saving of her and the making of Robbie. In the school holidays, Grace was allowed to bring her own 6-year-old along. Robbie grew up with the run of the nursery and those other parts of the house the children were permitted, as well as the grounds. His tree-climbing pal was Leon. Cecilia was the little sister who trustingly held his hand and made him feel immensely wise. A few years later, when Robbie won his scholarship to the local grammar, Jack Tallis took the first step in an enduring patronage by paying for the uniform and textbooks. This was the year Bryony was born. The difficult birth was followed by Emily's long illness. Grace's helpfulness secured her position. On Christmas Day that year, 1922, Leon, dressed in top hat and riding breeches, walked through the snow to the bungalow with a green envelope from his father. A solicitor's letter informed her that the freehold of the bungalow was now hers, irrespective of the position she held with the Tallises. But she had stayed on, returning to housework as the children grew older, with responsibilities for the special polishing. Her theory about Ernest was that he had got himself sent to the front under another name and never returned. Otherwise, his lack of curiosity about his son was inhuman. Often in the minutes she had to herself each day, as she walked from the bungalow to the house, she would reflect on the benign accidents of her life. She had always been a little frightened of Ernest. Perhaps they would not have been so happy together as she had been, living alone with her darling genius son in her own tiny house. If Mr. Tallis had been a different kind of man. Some of the women who came for a shilling's glimpse of the future had been left by their husbands, even more had husbands killed at the front. It was a pinched life the women led, and it easily could have been hers. "Nothing," he said in answer to her question. "There's nothing up with me at all." As he took up a brush and a tin of blacking, he said, "So the future's looking bright for Molly. She's going to remarry within 5 years, and she'll be very happy. Someone from the north with qualifications." "She deserves no less." They sat in comfortable silence while she watched him buffing his brogues with a yellow duster. By his handsome cheekbones the muscles twitched with the movement, and along his forearms they fanned and shifted in complicated rearrangements under the skin. There must have been something right with Ernest to have given her a boy like this. "So, you're off out." "Leon was just arriving as I was coming away. He had his friend with him, you know, the chocolate magnate. They persuaded me to join them for dinner tonight." "Oh, and there was me all afternoon on the silver and doing out his room." He picked up his shoes and stood. "When I look for my face in my spoon, I'll see only you." "Get on. Your shirts are hanging in the kitchen." He packed up the shoeshine box and carried it out and chose a cream linen shirt from the three on the era. He came back through and was on his way out, but she wanted to keep him a little longer. "And those Quincy children. That boy wetting his bed and all. The poor little lambs." He lingered in the doorway and shrugged. He had looked in and seen them round the pool, screaming and laughing through the late morning heat. They would have run his wheelbarrow into the deep end if he had not gone across. Danny Hardman was there too, leering at their sister when he should have been at work. "They'll survive," he said. Impatient to be out, he skipped up the stairs three at a time. Back in his bedroom, he finished dressing hurriedly, whistling tunelessly, as he stooped to grease and comb his hair before the mirror inside his wardrobe. He had no ear for music at all, and found it impossible to tell if one note was higher or lower than another. Now he was committed to the evening, he felt excited and strangely free. It couldn't be worse than it already was. Methodically and with pleasure in his own efficiency, as though preparing for some hazardous journey or military exploit, he accomplished the familiar little chores, located his keys, found a 10-shilling note inside his wallet, brushed his teeth, smelled his breath against a cupped hand, from the desk snatched up his letter and folded it into an envelope, loaded his cigarette case and checked his lighter. One last time he braced himself in front of the mirror. He bared his gums and turned to present his profile and looked across his shoulder at his image. Finally, he patted his pockets, then loped down the stairs three at a time again, called a farewell to his mother, and stepped out onto the narrow brick path which led between the flower beds to a gate in the picket fence. In the years to come, he would often think back to this time, when he walked along the footpath that made a shortcut through a corner of the oak woods and joined the main drive where it curved toward the lake and the house. He was not late, and yet he found it difficult to slow his pace. Many immediate and other less proximal pleasures mingled in the richness of these minutes. The fading reddish dusk, the warm, still air saturated with the scents of dried grasses and baked earth, his limbs loosened by the day's work in the gardens, his skin smooth from his bath, the feel of his shirt, and of this, his only suit. The anticipation and dread he felt at seeing her was also a kind of sensual pleasure, and surrounding it like an embrace was a general elation. It might hurt. It was horribly inconvenient. No good might come of it. but he had found out for himself what it was to be in love, and it thrilled him. Other tributaries swelled his happiness. He still derived satisfaction from the thought of his first, the best in his year, he was told. And now there was confirmation from Jack Tallis of his continuing support. A fresh adventure ahead. Not an exile at all. He was suddenly certain. It was right and good that he should study medicine. He could not have explained his optimism. He was happy and therefore bound to succeed. One word contained everything he felt and explained why he was to dwell on this moment later. Freedom. In his life as in his limbs. Long ago, before he had even heard of grammar schools, he was entered for an exam that led him to one. Cambridge, much as he enjoyed it, was the choice of his ambitious headmaster. Even his subject was effectively chosen for him by a charismatic teacher. Now, finally, with the exercise of will, his adult life had begun. There was a story he was plotting with himself as the hero, and already its opening had caused a little shock among his friends. Landscape gardening was no more than a bohemian fantasy as well as a lame ambition, so he had analysed it with the help of Freud, to replace or surpass his absent father. Schoolmastering. In 15 years' time, head of English, Mr. R. Turner, M.A., Cantab, was not in the story either, nor was teaching at a university. Despite his first, the study of English literature seemed in retrospect an absorbing parlour game, and reading books and having opinions about them the desirable adjunct to a civilised existence. But it was not the core, whatever Dr. Leavis said in his lectures. It was not the necessary priesthood, nor the most vital pursuit of an inquiring mind, nor the first and last defence against a barbarian horde, any more than the study of painting or music, history or science. At various talks in his final year, Robbie had heard a psychoanalyst, a communist trade union official, and a physicist each declare for his own field as passionately, as convincingly, as Leavis had for his own. Such claims were probably made for medicine, but for Robbie, the matter was simpler and more personal. His practical nature and his frustrated scientific aspirations would find an outlet. He would have skills far more elaborate than the ones he had acquired in practical criticism, and above all, he would have made his own decision. He would take lodgings in a strange town and begin. He had emerged from the trees and reached the point where the path joined the drive. The falling light magnified the dusky expanse of the park, and the soft yellow glow at the windows on the far side of the lake made the house seem almost grand and beautiful. She was in there, perhaps in her bedroom, preparing for dinner, out of view at the back of the building on the second floor, facing over the fountain. He pushed away these vivid daylight thoughts of her, not wanting to arrive feeling deranged. The hard soles of his shoes rapped loudly on the metal road like a giant clock, and he made himself think about time, about his great hoard, the luxury of an unspent fortune. He had never before felt so self-consciously young, nor experienced such appetite, such impatience for the story to begin. There were men at Cambridge who were mentally agile as teachers, and still played a decent game of tennis, still rode, who were 20 years older than him. 20 years at least in which to unfold his story at roughly this level of physical well-being, almost as long as he had already lived. 20 years would sweep him forward to the futuristic date of 1955. What of importance would he know then that was obscure now? Might there be for him another 30 years beyond that time, to be lived out at some more thoughtful pace? He thought of himself in 1962, at 50, when he would be old, but not quite old enough to be useless, and of the weathered, knowing doctor who would be by then, with the secret stories, the tragedies and successes stacked behind him. Also stacked would be books by the thousand, for there would be a study, vast and gloomy, richly crammed with the trophies of a lifetime's travel and thought, rare rainforest herbs, poisoned